You're basically saying, like, you know, like we have this ability as character actors to like carve out a lane, and there's certain parts where they live. But I don't live in LA, and like I live, like I still have to go to a fucking supermarket in New Jersey, and I've come to realize that by the standards of just people living their lives, I'm an odd looking man. I'm an odd looking person by the standards of just a supermarket in suburban New Jersey, you know? I'm a weird looking guy.
Yeah, maybe. Hello and welcome to Bald Talk, the podcast wherein two or less bald comedians chat with bald actors, writers, other comedians, serious people, and really anyone bald or bald adjacent about being bald. I'm Brian Husky, Bald Guild member number 45212. And once again, I'm flying solo as our other bald host, Charlie Sanders, is completing his manifesto in the woods before he calls the Great Awakening begins. So today, our guest is an accomplished actor, writer, stand-up, storyteller, podcaster, improviser, and while his greatest achievement in life was getting to be in three different improv groups with me, he seems to have done very well for himself since. His books include Lose Well and A Bad Idea I'm About to Do. His podcasts are Beautiful Anonymous and New Jersey is the World. He is part of the online performance collective Planet Scum. Born from the ashes of being trapped at home during the pandemic, he has appeared in numerous films and TV shows, such as The Other Guys, Space Force, but it is his own genre-challenging, self-created shows, which will reveal our guest's name, that are truly something special. He is the man behind The Chris Gethard Show and Chris Gethard's Presents. Please welcome, man, I am just mangling this. Please welcome Jimmy Fallon, kidding, Chris Gethard.
What's up, Chris? Husky?
What's up, Gether? Man, that was a mouthful.
Yeah.
We're recording this in the evening when I'm just like,
yeah,
given up because you had to put your youngest, your only, down for sleep.
Yeah, my wife is in California and I live in New Jersey. She's out there visiting friends and family.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's only been one other night in his life where she hasn't been here. I think she's only taken one night off. So
yeah.
She's going to take four in a row. So I had to get him down myself, and then my power immediately went out. So I'm sorry to keep you up so late.
It's all right, but you got a generator, which is a lesson for all of our listeners that as the world changes, we must change with it.
Yeah, I live in the woods, and we learned pretty quickly that this house does not have reliable power grid access. So we got the generator, so we're all good.
How long you been there? Like, I mean, because you're like not in the city, right? You're just out there.
I'm very disconnected from the city at this point. I bought a house January of 2020, which thank God, because then the housing market completely exploded, at least here in the Northeast.
Yeah.
Like, if it was even 6 months later, we wouldn't have been able to buy. So yeah, bought January of 2020 and then fixed the house up, and we were just about to move out of Queens. I was living in Queens two blocks from that hospital that the New York Times did the expose on, like the refrigerator trucks and stuff.
Yeah.
And dude, the night before my move, no exaggeration, our building told us they weren't allowing movers in. And we had a kid who wasn't even one. So then we got like stranded. We got in a big fight with our co-op board. And
luckily
my parents are snowbirds. So they were in Florida and they had a house in New York State, like way up north in the Adirondack Mountains. And we just like wound up hiding up there for months.
Oh, so, wow. Wait, a snowbird is someone who's splits their time between Florida and some retirement
chalet. They spend like 9 months a year in Florida, and then when it's just like too swampy and hot in Florida, they come and they hang out in upstate New York, and that's when I get to see them still mostly. So it was like the story of our moving. Was it was kind of like we were all set to go just before the pandemic, and then the pandemic messed that up. But now we've been out in Jersey for about 2 years, and yeah, man, I live like out in the woods, like, you know, there's a bunch of areas where a lot of the artists move, and this is like an hour drive beyond all those areas.
That I never experienced in the 10 years I lived in Brooklyn and New York, adjacent to New Jersey.
Yeah.
I went there very little, but when people are like, yeah, there's like the woods of New Jersey and stuff, I go, no, it's just, to me, it was just a wasteland off the turnpike.
Yeah.
Kind of world.
That is how most people think of it, but
yeah,
yeah, it's pretty. I'm as you know, I mean, you knew me. It's funny, when we first met, I was still literally a college student in New Jersey. And
yeah,
like very known from, I worked in a magazine about New Jersey, and everybody knew I was like very connected to New Jersey, and then lived in New York for 16 years, and then it was time to move and raise the kid not in the city. And it was it was funny because my wife grew up in Westchester and was like, how come we can't, like, we were thinking about moving up there, and she's like, I wish there was a part of Jersey that looked like Westchester. And I was like, there's a million parts that look like Westchester, just gotta know where to find them.
Yeah,
we have trees here, trees and bushes and waterways and all sorts of stuff, man. It's nice.
Nice.
Yeah.
Is it, does it feel like a, because the older I get, I'm just like, I just want to be away from civilization more and more. Does it feel like a shift in you, like as far as like creativity or socialization, which is all fucked up because of pandemic?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like there's the reference point for that is out the window, but.
Well, I think the answer to that question, I think, ties heavily into some of the themes that you guys cover here, because, mm-hmm. I mean, like you said, COVID made it all screwy no matter what, but I also did move like very far away. And I was always someone between UCB and then my own projects. I was always someone where the whole point was kind of like rally a community, you know?
Yeah.
And for a bunch of years there with my old TV show, I was kind of like the center point of community. And I think I look back at it, and this wasn't necessarily something that was intentional. It was just kind of instinct, but I think UCB in New York was maybe like getting in the phase where people were starting to feel like it was corporatizing or like mm-hmm. squeeze. Maybe it's fair to say, like, because I mean, we could talk for hours just about the actual actual unhinged people that we were sharing the stage with and classes with.
Oh,
and like,
yeah, yeah.
And then I felt like my work in New York maybe carried the torch on that. I think like my old public access show in particular was like, hey, this is mm-hmm. where like a lot of weirdos can come hang out and a lot of really great people too. And that mixture was always nice. And it's funny, Husker, because like I was the kid, like of our scene, I was the kid. When I showed up I was 19 or 20 years old when I started taking classes, and like you and Bowie and Cordry and Seth in particular, like you guys looked out for me, and I felt very protected by like you guys and a handful of other people.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden it was like my TV show got canceled in 2018, and I was 38 or 39 at the time, and I was very, very tired and very burnt out from getting notes, and my wife and I were trying to have a baby. And then I moved out to the woods in New Jersey, and it has been a kind of like stark realization of like, oh, like I was part of UCB, which was like the coolest shit going in its day. And then I built a bunch of stuff as an individual that had a very hip reputation.
Yeah.
Like very underground. And then all of a sudden it was like a bunch of stuff I made kind of like, it was like a swing and a miss. And it was like the first time where I'd had some whiffs where just like the world collectively was like, ah.
What were the whiffs? Like, because, and I only say that because looking at all the stuff you've done, like I think everybody has this in sort of reaction to what other people do. Like they're very hard on themselves. I'm very hard on myself. And I, you know, I'm going through my own kind of like, oh man, do it. What, like, is this what I want? Have I done what I wanted? Will there be more? You know, and then it gets into like gatekeepers and feeling like, you can only do as much as they allow or whatever.
Right.
But my perspective on what you've done is from a very like intrinsically, artistically, like it has merit and it has like a truth that is true to you.
Thank you.
Yeah. And I think that's like one of the best accomplishments you can do in, because it's, I mean, it's like the marriage of art and commerce is going to, capitalism sucks. And so
health insurance sucks.
Yeah.
I was thinking about that today. I'm like, I had my own TV show. I've written 4 books. I had an HBO special, and I still sit around and I worry about, am I going to have health insurance in 18 months? I'm like, what must it be like for people who aren't as lucky as I am and who have, you know, like I'm like a white guy whose parents were kind to him. Like I had a lot of stuff going for me, And I still sit here, and I live in this nice house in the woods. I still sit here and go, man, am I going to have health insurance in a year and a half? And that's like one of the only reasons I even still deal with any of this shit.
Yeah.
For health insurance. And then I sit here and I think things like that. And I go, God damn, man, that's like such a turnaround. I was so passionate about it, but I was also so angry for so many. That's another thing I think you and I always quietly linked up with of like, pretty mild-mannered people who definitely had some chip on the shoulder and definitely, you know, I definitely wanted to like prove a lot of people wrong. And then I think I went and accomplished a lot of stuff that made me feel like simultaneously like I did. And then I also turned around and was like, wait, there was nobody, who was I proving wrong? Like no one was mad at me. No one was against me. And like, all those feelings. So yeah, I've been feeling like, I feel that's very kind of you to say. And I do feel like so much, I do feel so proud of all the stuff I've done. I also know, so like, just to get nuts and bolts, like when my HBO special came out, my manager was like, man, like you had this coming out. You were just in like Birbiglia's movie. I did the improv, the Don't Think Twice About the, which is basically about the stepfathers, you know, in a lot of ways.
Yeah, yeah.
Like very, very much, I think like, I wouldn't say inspired because I don't think Mike wrote it with the stepfathers in mind, but he was definitely sit there asking me sometimes like, so Bobby got SNL and you were on a team with him. That must have been weird, huh? Me being like, oh yeah, this and that. And
yeah, yeah.
It was in the DNA of it. You know, he and I certainly were very closely linked then. And I had the my podcast, Beautiful and Honest, blew up and my manager was like, you should not go back to the Gethard show right now. Like, I know you're going to, but like, you should not be going back to True TV. We should be trying to make you like, the guy who's in the circuit of like, you did an HBO special and the NPR people all love you.
Right.
Like you're this and that. And he's like, you're going to lose a lot of momentum if you go back. And then I did another year. I did another season of the Gethard show and he proved totally correct. And I have felt since then, like when the Gethard show ended, it was like, oh, and that marks the end of this massive chapter of this life that had my fucking name on it.
Yeah.
And you can't go back all of a sudden and be like, remember how 2 or 3 years ago I had, man, that HBO special that had all that critical praise? Like, can I get that moment? All those opportunities that I was turning down to stick with my TV show. Anybody want to give me those again?
And it's like,
so all good problems to have. And like you say, like all artistic merit for sure. But I definitely feel like a guy living in New Jersey right now who's not, the phone's not ringing off the hook. Like, I did not get one business related email today.
Yeah.
And like, that would, a couple years ago, that would have been actually impossible. Like, I just had so much going on, and now I got nothing. And some of that's a choice.
Yeah.
Some of that's being a dad. Some of that's opting to move out to the woods of Morris County, New Jersey, somehow get further away from LA after 20 years in New York.
Yeah.
And some of it just freaks me out, too. You know, some of it makes me feel like, okay, like I had a good career, and I really feel like I had a good career, and I'm proud of that.
You never know, though. I mean, it's, and again, that is the voice you have in your head, and which is can be a voice of worry, or it can be a voice of kind of like remembrance, you know, or like holding up what was in a different light than maybe it really was compared to what you have now. I mean, that's for me, that kind of like, what is that? Like that thing where like people who sort of nostalgia, you know, like leaning into the nostalgia of like, oh man, look at this period when I was just like so busy, da da da. And I know for me personally, like the periods that I was really busy, I was still feeling like it wasn't enough, or it wasn't the things that are going to lead to the next thing. And you know, it then it just gets into that thing of like, hey, you really got to appreciate what's going on, because no one knows how to do this really. I mean, it's interesting you say, like, your manager is like, I think you should step away. But that could have been a whiff too. He doesn't know.
Could have.
You know?
And then I would have given up something I really cared about and like betrayed all these people who stuck with me for years
on
public access TV. Like there were a million reasons to not. And like I married the band leader from the show. We have a kid now. Like clearly that was the choice. But then, you know, it's the other side of it too is I think of all this and I go, well, I think so much about, I panic so much now because I'm less busy.
Mm-hmm.
But was I happy then?
Yeah.
I don't know that is a definitive yes either. Like I actually think about like what's the stretches of my life where I was happiest.
Mm-hmm.
Probably it was like 2011, 12, 13 when my show was on public access and everybody thought it was like a real, I mean, I had people actually intervening. I had like my friend JD who wound up being like the showrunner of my show the whole time. he had someone pull him aside right in the beginning of public access and was like, don't attach yourself to Gethard's fucking mental breakdown. It's a public access TV show. What the fuck is he doing? You know? Yeah. So I had people who thought I was actually losing my mind, and I might have been. I don't know. And like,
yeah,
I was losing money on it back then. I was like pouring money into the. I was taking that money from that Comedy Central show that I did with Horatio.
Yeah.
And like managing to like.
Did they think you're losing your mind because you were so obsessive and obsessed with it?
Yeah. And it was just, I mean, it was so, I look back and I'm like, man, like, I remember talking with Bobby about it after, because it was like, so for anybody who doesn't know, like, we all came up together and I started when I was a kid. I really got attached to John Bowie, John Ross Bowie, who a lot of people know from his various shows. I had been a fan of his band when I was in high school.
Right.
So he loved that. And then when he linked up at UCB, he kind of realized, oh, here's this other like nerdy kid who likes punk rock who knew my band. He looked out for me a lot. And then you and him were working together and you guys had a crew. And it turned out you were kind of like all ex-punk rockers.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I first got to know you, was because you guys had this crew that had like some status, and Bowie really protected me. And then you and Seth, like, clearly there was a team that like I was... You guys could have just been like, nah, this kid's not ready. And you guys let me join your team. And then that was a big thing for me and blah, blah, blah. And then that went on for years, just like with all of us. And then, you know, UCB started blowing up and everybody's moving to LA. And then Zach gets The Office and Bobby gets SNL. And I was just like, oh my God, just all the things that we all think about. And you see all your friends and you're like, I'm so happy for my friends and I'm so fucking scared. And then I got this show Big Lake on Comedy Central, which was supposed to be huge. And it was like, kind of the first, I'm not even beating myself up on this. I think out of that whole UCB like string of insane success that was like this legendary thing to say, I think it was the biggest flop out of anybody who busted out. Just like the show that it didn't work. And then it was less than a year later, I was hosting the public access show and people were like, dude, you were just on a sitcom and now you're hosting a public access show. So I think people might have thought I was losing it a little bit, but I was more just like, I remember just like not being that upset when that sitcom failed, because I was just like, I don't really watch sitcoms.
Yeah, I know that there's so many like
why do I care?
I skipped on an audition for something that was like, it was like 11 pages, and I would have had to have it in by 9 a.m. tomorrow, and I was like, I don't like this stuff. I don't want to do this stuff. I'm not going to stress about it. But that's a big difference than when I used to. I used to sort of feel like, but I mean, they're throwing me this little life preserver and I have to take it. And you know,
what
and
if this somehow offends the casting director?
Yeah, totally.
What if my agents think I'm a prima donna?
Yeah. And I love my agent now. He's like, eh, don't worry about it. It's fine.
Yeah, mine are getting real tired of me, man. Because I'm in another phase of sorting it out. I'm in another phase of trying to figure out what to do, as I always am.
I've jumped like three different places. When I got to where I am now, I was like, here's the deal with me. Like, I don't want to do stuff that's going to mess up my family relations. That's like a big important thing to me. And I don't want to do anything that, I just don't want to do stuff because it feels like it's out of desperation. Because it started to feel like it was just kind of like, well, you don't really have anything, so you just got to take what comes along. And the difference was those agents weren't good. You know, they weren't like doing their jobs. I was basically just saying, like, so find stuff that's good for me, and there will be times that there aren't any things that are good for me, and that's okay.
And people have started to realize, and I don't bring that much to the table the past few years. Like I said, like it's been uphill, but I got people right now who got my back. I just switched again like last year. And it's like, you also got to realize with me, like I'm not trying to sound dramatic and I'm not trying to sound cool. Just when I say like, I don't particularly like most people who would want to be involved with this industry.
Yeah.
I think it's a weird industry. And like, I've chosen to live in New York and New Jersey my whole career. I've chosen to do public access TV. And like, everything good that I've done, it's because I managed to find a backdoor to it.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope I can continue that. But like, if you want to work with me, you also got to realize, like, I'm gonna be a pain in the ass.
Yeah.
Because I legitimately am very wary and distrustful of anyone who wants to, like, be a development executive. Like, what the fuck
right.
is broken in you that that's appealing? You know what I mean? Like, the fuck is going on that you want to do that? Like, that's my perspective.
I think you, I feel like you and I have always had that kind of, I think, I feel like there's a lot of people in improv who have that kind of, like, we want to do this thing, which is, you know, distilled down to, like, we want to perform, we want to act, we want to make people laugh. The thing that that is housed in is a fucking, the anus of a monster. Great. We have to go into the anus of this monster and do it. And some people don't recognize it as a monster's anus. They're like, no, this is great. This is so cool. And then
you see friends you love get sucked into the monster's anus, and they forget that it's always been that and it's still that. And you watch them go and you're like, oh.
Yeah.
Either they figured it out in a way that my ego won't allow me to because I'm hanging on to this, or I'm watching my friends turn shittier because now they're on that side of the cool kids line.
And it's weird. Fuck. Like, it's hard not to sort of, like, say that out loud and sound like, well, you're just being self-protective. You know what I mean? That you're just, for me, I'm speaking, like, it's like, how much of that is you're just sort of fearful of being rejected, or just fear of rejection and stuff. And I think it's like the times I've been in sort of upper level situations, it is a thing of like, I don't feel the same things and see things the same way as a lot of people at that upper level, because I don't think I have the same kind of, like, the ambition need I have is not as, I don't know. It's more personal, and it's still, even to this day, something I'm trying to prove to myself and not to others.
Yeah, big time.
I don't know how healthy that is sometimes. You know, sometimes I think...
Who knows? None of this. I mean, no one involved in any of this is a healthy person, right?
But it is. I guess so, but it's like going back to me saying that everything you've done has... My point of view is it has a true artistic merit because it is...
Thanks, dude.
Yeah, because you really do... You investigate yourself through this process a lot, which is really great. I mean, I think even, you know, I've talked with people who are like, yeah, I seem to get cast in these roles that oddly have, like, mimic something I grew up with. And I like that when people sort of fall into doing work that is unconsciously investigating something that's going on with them. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I think a lot of people don't, which is fine too. You know, there's, like, versions all over the place, but because I was, like, did photography and the music and then this, I've always been into the kind of DIY version, whether it's, like, outsider art, even kind of stuff. I'm just like, they're just doing it because they feel the need to. And I think that's great.
And dude, on that note too, I don't think I've ever told you this, and because I don't even know if it was something that was, like, a concrete thought when I showed up, but between you, Bowie, Mandzukas, finding out that Cordry had that music background, like, I realized when I showed up at UCB, I was like, oh, this feels to me like the shows I used to go to music shows and feel like I really loved them for what they were. And I was never going to be a musician, but I was like, oh, I can go to a VFW hall or an Elks Lodge and watch bands in New Jersey, and I feel like I can take a breath and let my goddamn guard down.
Yeah.
And then when I showed up in New York and you guys who I just named were all there, and I realized, like, I'm watching you, and there was something about you, there was something about certain people around that scene where I'd be like, these people, like, if they're doing it, I feel like I'm allowed to do it. And then to a human, it turned out it was a lot of those people who made me feel like that were also the ones who had the same music background I did.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I've brought it up on this podcast quite a few times, but it's like me stumbling into UCB was going from one music scene to an equivalent music scene. I was like, oh, this makes sense to me. This makes sense of this idea of, like, it's a community that is a collection of groups that are competing against each other and hugely supportive of one another. Right. You know, it is this collective kind of thing.
You're safe here. Yeah. I just felt fucking safe, and I did not feel safe. I was 20 years old, man, and fucking miserable. And then what a perfect confluence of events that that theater had not blown up yet. And I got in like just at that tail end of when you like could just hang out and they'd eventually throw you on stage just to see if you could stick, because all of a sudden I was just like, oh, I have not felt like a safe haven like this since I was like 14, 15 years old. And my older brother brought me to punk shows and I was like, all these kids are fucking losers. This is awesome.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden it was like UCB was that, except you didn't need to know how to play an instrument. You could just try to be smart and funny. It was fucking awesome.
Yeah.
But then it's funny too, because you saying that like I've done all this work that's explored myself, it also makes me laugh, because I've said many times on record, I'm like, people have given me credit for that and been like, you've said some like really honest stuff, and you've like present like the TV show, like you would sometimes you'd like do really emotional stuff in the guise of this completely insane fucking like show. And I'm like, yeah, because when I came up, the people, I was like, I had to become very, very honest on stage. And I realized that at a certain point, because I was like subconsciously realizing I cannot keep up with the people I'm on stage with comedically. Like, I was 20 years old on a team with you and Seth and Jack McBrayer. I'm like, well, I am going to be at best maybe the third funniest one on stage if one of you guys like has the flu. You know what I mean? Like, you guys were just so relentlessly fucking funny. Like, and that was my second team I was ever on, was with like Brian Husky, Seth Morris, and Jack McBrayer. Like, the fuck? And then my whole track was always being like I always felt like I always thought I was funny, don't get me wrong, but I always felt like I was like a glue guy. Like, stepfathers had Bobby and Zach and you, and like Sunshine Gang, you and Billy dressed in, like, it's the fucking 30, Chad Carter. Like, all right, like everyone here is fucking funnier than me, and then I'm supposed to be like the smarty pants guy, and Chad's here, he's more smarty pants than I am. So I just realized at a certain point, I was like, all these people respect me on stage. They let me get on stage with them. And like, you got to fight to keep up. And like you said, it's competitive, so you got to compete. So I just, at a certain point, I was like, oh, everyone else feels safest in a character, but I think I'm like, out of everyone around me, I might be the most okay about being like,
yeah,
and I'll just ramble for 9 straight minutes about sexual side effects from antidepressants when we're still in an era of history when no one talks about going to therapy. Like, I just realized, like, I'm totally comfortable talking about shit.
Yeah.
And a lot of that was necessity, because how the fuck was I supposed... Dude, I was in a group after you left town. Like, I was in this group that had all this hype called Five Dudes, and the Five Dudes were me, Zach Woods, Bobby Moynihan, Charlie Sanders, and Eugene Cordero. It's just like, I was always good enough and funny enough to be in those environments. But I was never going to be the fucking balls out funniest one. No way.
Yeah, but I mean,
sometimes steal the show, maybe, if I got lucky. But pound for pound funniest? The fuck out of here, man. I had to figure out something else.
I guess so. Do you feel like you literally figured that out, or just kind of started? You started noticing, like, oh, if I just be myself, it's working.
Well, I realized, like, because I started noticing that, like, where I could really keep up is that when we'd all be at McManus after shows and everybody's sitting around telling stories, I started to realize that a lot of people were like, you're a good storyteller and your life seems to have had some insane aspects. Like, you got all these stories about getting in fights, and meanwhile you're this like tiny little nerd and you work at a magazine about ghosts in New Jersey. Like, I remember Cordry in particular getting such a fucking delight out of like finding out my day job was I worked at a magazine about ghosts in New Jersey. Yeah. I just remember him.
Well, he loves
like,
ghosts anyway.
So like, I noticed people would want to hear my stories off stage. Like, that's where the other comedians would be like, we'd be at the bar and I'd be like, oh, well, this happened to me once. And people would be like, what the fuck are you talking about? And I organized a storytelling show because I noticed it was like, I'd be around it and be like Curtis Gwynn Anthony Tamanik. Mm-hmm. They had that too, of like, if they got going at a bar, they could just hold court with their fucking stories. And I wound up starting a storytelling show, which was one of the early comedic storytelling shows in New York. It was called Nights of Our Lives.
Oh yeah, I remember that.
And a lot of it was, that was like 2006, and that was just me going like, I want to create a space that's just, I don't have to try to like commit to a character and keep up with Husky and Seth. Like, I love those guys, but like, I want to create a show because I think I'm really good at this, and I think this is a blend of like the UCB style.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is not going to be The Moth where you have to learn a lesson.
Right.
Like, that's not what Curtis and Anthony are doing when we sit around in a bar. That's not what people are responding to.
Purging.
It's vomiting up all this fucking shit. So I noticed there were a handful of us that had that ability, and I created a show.
Mm-hmm.
And again, now I'm trying to keep up with Curtis and Anthony and John Flynn and all these other great storytellers, but I was much more able to carve out my own space by doing that. And that's when I also started doing a lot of times, if like that monologist at ASCAT no-showed.
Right.
Amy would say, like, Gethard, you just take over as the monologist. And I just got such a better response doing the monologues than mm-hmm. I did doing the scenes.
Well, I, like, when you started doing that, I think I feel like I was still around.
Yeah.
And, my perspective, I was like, holy shit, like, Gethard has moved up to this kind of, you know, because their monologists are like Alec Baldwin and fucking, you know, Andy Richter and all these people come in. So to me it was sort of like, that was a true vote of like, yeah, your voice is strong, you know.
Yeah, but that was one of my first big red flags of like, I'm a good improviser.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I always took a lot of pride, because I feel like consistently people have looked back and been like, I've had a lot of people tell me you're one of the people I liked being on stage with the best. I've had a lot of people say, like, as far as like a point guard who could hold a show together and pass the ball, like, I think a lot of the reason why I wound up on stage with the funniest people at any given time was because they all trusted me to like hold a show together, and that gave them the freedom to go fucking apeshit, and that was nice.
Yeah, I did not feel that way, but that's...
No. But this was a dip. Like,
I
you and...
I found you to be distracting and like a real
kind of needy. Yeah. I mean, you sat me down a number of times.
I was like, oh my God, one, stop wearing your glitter jacket. You're wearing that glitter jacket. Like,
I mean, it took me years to realize that other teams didn't do the double notes thing. Cause you told me, okay, we'll get our notes from our coach and our director.
Yeah, and then we'll have private notes with me.
And then I'm your mentor and you're my protege, and then you'll get individual notes from me, and that was extensive.
Yeah.
That was often like,
and then we do the 2 a.m. notes longer.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I'd wake
and,
you up.
And then it would be, sometimes you wouldn't even let me go to sleep. Sometimes you'd be like, now you just walk around this block
and think about what I said.
Yeah, and I'll come find you again.
And do better.
And you'd always find, it would always be like, you'd be in the passenger seat of a car and it was never the same guy driving it twice. It was always...
No.
The 2 a.m. notes actually were really... There are a lot of things I did that you told me it was gonna make me better at improv.
Yeah.
And I looked back, and back then I thought they were kind of like, you know, Del Close, like guru, sort of weird, like, exercises.
But now you recognize they're psychosexual kind of things, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, sorry about that.
Oftentimes criminal.
Yeah. Yeah. But now, pandemic, so...
Yeah.
Everything goes.
And I was really young. There were a lot of places where we'd like get admission where I realized like you weren't allowed in unless you brought a boy who wasn't of drinking age.
We'll stop this bit right there.
None of that's true.
No, that's true. None of that's true. All aboard talk. Ever heard of social media? We have, and no big deal, we are on it. Check us out on Instagram at Bald Talk Pod or on Twitter at Bald Talk Podcast.
Please make sure to like, rate, and review, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
We don't care where you get them, just get them.
No judgment, wherever you get them, anywhere.
Anywhere, whatever, no judgment.
As long as you listen, we don't give a fuck. Only on Bald
Talk. When I felt like I got to shine was when it was like, oh, improv has gotten me here.
Mm-hmm.
And it's taught me how to be on stage in a different way than like a stand-up.
Yeah.
But when I get to get up and have some breathing room to just talk and tell some stories, that's when I felt like crowds were like, okay.
Right.
Now we see who this guy is. And a lot of that was a conscious thing of just like, I cannot keep up with pound for, I can keep up in like so many ways with anybody, but pound for pound funny, I cannot keep up with the people I'm on stage with. And there's a lot of joy to be had in that.
I know, but I don't know if that's true, because you were consistently put in situations where you were having to do that. You know what I mean? I think that's,
yeah.
I mean, I feel the same, that, you know, I have the same feeling with certain people. I'm like, holy shit, this person just looks at the, like, lifts their head up and they lose their shit.
See, that was you to me, man. That was you and Seth.
Yeah. No, it's
from
so funny.
From the start, I was like, fuck, these guys are automatic. Everything they do crushes.
That's good to hear. I need to hear that right now, because I have not improvised in fucking 2 years. Like, yeah, only this online stuff. It's bad.
I haven't done improv in... I'd largely stopped in 2012 and just started focusing more and more on stand-up. And there's times where I miss it.
Yeah.
I
can never get into stand-up. I just, you know, there's something about, I just, I had so many people say that I should give it a shot, and I've tried a couple nights, but I just, there's something just revisiting material and kind of the kind of legwork of it. I was like, not for me.
I learned to enjoy it. I learned to enjoy the control and the manipulation of it and all that. And yeah.
Let me ask you a question just so we can rationalize the premise of our podcast.
Yeah.
You have a distinctive widow's peak.
And I've had it forever.
You've had it forever. And I will confess to you, like, I've had hair envy of you.
No.
Honestly, I genuinely have been, I was just like, dude, I love it. I love that.
See, I feel like I've been, so people have told me I've been going bald since my early 20s.
Yeah.
And this widow's peak is demonstrably more pronounced than it was when I was 22 or 23, but I had the widow's peak even back then.
Yeah.
My grandfather had it too. You can see I've grown a beard for the first time in my life.
Right.
And that was 2 months ago I started growing it.
Mm-hmm.
Largely because I'm like, I think the end is nigh, and I need to know what I'm dealing with facial hair-wise before I shave my head.
Right.
Because I've hit a point where every time I see a new barber, I'll say to them, like, you can be honest if I got to shave it.
Yeah.
Let me know. Because this up here is much more of an island than a peninsula at this point.
But you don't have anything going on in the back, right? It's all still in there.
No, this is all in here. And then this, yeah. But it's very thin in here now. Like,
yeah.
It's going to hit that point where this little horn of hair at the front of my head is just going to be surrounded by skin. And that's going to feel real weird.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know if I'm going to like it.
Yeah. Well, you've had your hair pretty short before, right?
I have. I was ruthlessly mocked for the size of my forehead through my entire childhood.
Comedically, you are a type, you know? Like, I'm a type, you're a type. And your packaging has some very distinctive elements and stuff. And I've always been really doing this podcast. One of the things that's fascinating to me is that thing of, like, comedy people, like, we get to be a little weird looking or whatever by, you know, beauty standards. And that is also a weapon that we will wield against you. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But at the same time, I'm not totally psyched to be bald. You know, I went through, I'm fine with it now, but I went through an achingly long time where I was just like, fucking hate it secretly. No, I'm cool. I'm cool. I fucking hate it. I hate it. You know? And so
I grew in this beard because I'm like, I got to know what my facial hair options are.
Yeah.
I have said to my wife, and she's gotten sad, where I've been like, I think I need to start trying to get kind of jacked, because I think if I'm going to shave my head, I want to be in better. Like, I think guys who, like, I think when people shave their head to, what would you say? I mean, what phrase? To succumb or to, like, start going
accept.
With the flow?
You just accept.
Right? Yeah. To, like, start.
Your transition.
No longer swimming against stream and just allow the current to take you.
Yeah.
I'm like, I feel like I need to be, like, muscular to pull that up. She's like, please stop. This is so sad to hear you say that.
It is. Well, I mean, that, you know, one of the truisms that we've hit on is, like, like totally jacked dudes who are bald, you don't notice because their whole body just feels like one big muscle. And so their head is just like another bicep or something.
Yeah. I have a giant head and like a doughy little body. And here's the real thing, Husky. Here's the real thing that freaks me out about it is like, we see, I don't really have eyebrows. Like my eyebrow hair is so blonde and light.
Yeah.
That I don't really have eyebrows. So like,
you gotta wear glasses. You gotta keep the glasses then.
Well, I was gonna get LASIK a couple years ago, and a friend of mine, as a comedian, who said something, said it in a mean way, like to be funny and hurt, and accomplished it.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also truth where she was like, "You can't get LASIK. You need those glasses to break up your face," and phrased it like that.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of truth to it, but it does also give me fear about the, because there ain't, you've known me forever at this point, like over 20 years, like. It's a really weird situation because it's like I've always had this hairline, but it's just more and more severe. And at what point do I just say shave it all?
But you know, again, like my refrain is going to be, our it's hard to have self perspective. It's really, and so my perspective on you is like you look exactly the same, and I've taken offense when people are like, Husky, you've looked the exact same for, you know, 15 years. I'm like, I was not this bald a long time ago. So you've saying I've been this bald, and you're like, yeah, basically. I mean, it's just sort of like, it's just varying degrees of it and stuff. But I've kept like, you know, extensive awareness of the patterning of my hair loss and how much has gone back and all that kind of stuff. Because I mean, we're driving the same car our whole life. So we're going to notice all the dings on it.
It's these areas. Like, there was a part of me, especially when I was like doing my TV show, where I felt like maybe I should just shave it all and try to have like a mohawk and make this feel like a choice instead of just like a genetic curse.
Yeah.
That this part's out here on its own.
But again, like it's such an extra unstated, like, button, just how we look, you know what I mean? That if you do something funny or you have a perspective or whatever, and I think for you, there, you were kind of coming from like a kind of nerdy vulnerability. And so it's that kind of like, yeah, this is it.
Let me ask you this though. Like, I'm jealous of you being in LA because they're like, you're basically saying like, you know, like we have this ability as character actors to like carve out a lane, and there's certain parts where they live, but I don't live in LA, and like I live, like I still have to go to a fucking supermarket in New Jersey. And I've come to realize that by the standards of just people living their lives, I'm an odd looking man. I'm an odd looking person by the standards of just a supermarket in suburban New Jersey. You know?
Yeah.
I'm a weird looking guy.
Yeah, maybe.
I always felt like that with commercial acting. Did you ever feel like that when you got into commercials? When I'm like, oh, there's a lot of very talented people where they are actors, and either commercial acting is where their talents seem to be clicking the most, or this is a stop on the way towards other stuff they're going to be doing. Mm-hmm. And then there's a whole other class of people who not only survive, but thrive in commercials.
Yeah.
Purely because they just kind of look fucking weird.
Yeah.
And if you can sell gum and you're weird enough that people will be like, oh, this guy's weird, I'll watch the whole commercial.
Yeah.
But you're not so weird that it's not like offensive to the gum.
Yeah, you're not distracting from the gum so much.
Yeah.
Like, I don't want to associate this gum with that person.
Exactly. Like, you can have a great career in commercial acting.
Yeah.
Literally not having... And I'm not being judgmental here, like not having ever taken an acting class or gotten on stage.
I feel like I grew up on just a whole, it's probably like a generation before, but all these like weird 60s actors who played the exact same person everywhere. You know what I mean? Like the rumpled old lady or the, you know, the doughy dude who just, you know what I mean? And I was fascinated by it. I was like, oh my God, these people, they just show up and do their thing. And I loved it. And then I honestly, like when I started to sort of feel like, oh man, I'm showing up and doing my thing. Is that all I'm going to be doing? It, bummed me out a little bit. Like, I wanted to do some other things.
Yeah. I'm glad I've maintained, like, a real dedication to, like, solo performing, because it allows me to combat against that. Because really the only acting gigs I ever get are, like, okay, here's a person who gets kind of, like, shitted on, but maybe could be, like, I hate to say this, like, I'm making light of something horrible, but it's like, oh, this guy could be like a school shooter if he would stand up for himself, but he doesn't, so he's like a harmless punching bag. Those are all the roles I get.
Yeah.
Everything I do acting-wise.
The tiny ticking, like, time bomb?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Like the nerd who gets pushed around a lot, who, like, if he would stand up for himself, might be dangerous, but he doesn't, so that makes it palatable for a sitcom bit part.
It's so weird. I mean, that it keeps coming up, but just this thing in comedy, which I, you know, more and more I think it's changing, but a lot of comedy bits are built on sort of like broad stereotyping or deep stereotyping. And I sounds weird, but it's like, I hope we don't lose that, because people are the sum of their experiences, and a lot of experiences become sort of like social standards. And so you can say, like, oh, this guy is from this region, he's that way, he's going to have this attitude and stuff. But I think in comedy, like, the shorthand is like, and we're going to distill it down to the smallest little detail of that, and that's going to be a punch, you know, and then you're going to have this reaction, you know, and it's up to you after having that reaction, if you think about it or if you're just like, reinforce it or something.
And you're really, I think you're also really masterful at the exact, like, I've seen you do a number of things that have made me laugh, where it's like a very quick hit of like, oh, there's Husky in a scene. Oh, and something kind of crazy happened.
Yeah.
Either to his character or more in the vicinity. And it's just a big reaction. And it's exactly what you're saying of, like, to the American public, they're effectively saying, like, you know, a guy who looks kind of like this, who could react to something like this in this way.
Yeah.
And I see what you mean.
I, in a weird way, I feel like memes are doing that.
Right.
That memes are this little distilled kind of like truism. And then they get used to destroy our democracy as well. So they're very powerful.
Yeah.
Be careful, everybody.
I was once in Brazil, and it's a very long and convoluted story, but I was having sort of a, not quite breakdown, but on the verge of one.
Yeah, just a casual kind of like melting.
You've seen that happen to me a couple of times over the years, where it's clearly like, oh, you're on the brink of something bad, but hold it together. And a friend of mine is a filmmaker, and he had a film in a festival in Brazil, and he was like, come to Brazil and like decompress and... let's get you the fuck out of New York for a while. Yeah. And we went down there, and it's like I said, long story short, but he had a very distant cousin. His mom was there and was trying to like hook me up with the cousin.
Mm-hmm.
The cousin did not know English. And then his mom mentioned I was a comedian. His mom started trying to claim I was the next Woody Allen, and I was like, no.
I don't want to be any number of reasons.
Like, first of all, it's not true. Second of all, a weird comparison to make.
Yeah.
And when she found out,
you knew some of the allegations were coming.
Oh, they were already starting to bubble up. I was like, not a good one. Not a good one to make anymore.
Yeah. Albert Brooks, take that one.
And then the girl turned out she knew perfect English. She had just been pretending to not speak English because she did not want to be speaking to me. Mm-hmm. And all these people were like, you should hook up with this American friend. And she was like, leave me alone. But when she found out I was a comedian, the reason I'm bringing it up is because she immediately was like, do you know Mr. Bean?
And
I was
like,
no, I don't know Mr. Bean. And she was like, I'm obsessed with Mr. Bean. And then it turned out she was totally cool. This girl was like a filmmaker and a visual artist and like awesome. And we're Facebook friends now, and like she does installations all over fucking Holland and stuff. She's super rad. And she started talking to me about Mr. Bean, and I came to realize like Mr. Bean is internationally famous, and I think it's like what you said. I think he was like able to, without a single word, capture something about the human experience that today would just be memes.
Yeah.
But like Mr. Bean is just a guy who looks funny and stuff happens to him, and he reacts in ways where you're like, yeah, I've seen people react like, I've seen like nerds like that react like that.
Yeah.
And he built like an international devotion based on his ability to like raise his eyebrow when a fucking bike comes by and splashes mud on him.
Totally. He was, he was a Mr. Magoo cartoon kind of come to life or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's amazing. Good for him. You know what?
Yeah.
He had a pretty
good
It
gave me a whole deep level of respect for Mr. Bean that I had not considered from my like hipster New York City comedy scene perspective before.
Yeah. It's one of those things where like, when you see people sort of employ like, wow, you do like a couple of things, or you use just a couple of tools and you're able to like create this massive, massive thing with it, this broad world out of it. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
We are coming up near the end because we try to keep it under 6 hours. But I do, before we go, want to apologize to you for something that I've always felt very bad about. When we were
apologized to me for?
Well, when we went on, we used to do tour co-shows through UCB.
Oh.
And there was one time that we were all quite high.
That was fucked up.
And this is one of those examples of like where comedians can go so hard on a bit that it goes from funny to cruel. And so
that
the
was
bit
fucked up.
The bit I kept doing.
It was very funny though.
It was very funny, but it was also like knowing like, yeah, when people are when their mental state is affected and they shift into another place that maybe they can't get out of, it's not cool to fuck with them. But you were really,
I should also say that I've never been someone who gets high very often.
Yeah.
It's once in a blue moon. I haven't been high in years. And even back then, it was not something I was regularly in the rhythm of. But yes.
So we all got high.
Did we eat pot cookies maybe?
I don't know where it came from, but it was like we're in this shitty motel room.
Yeah.
And we're all really high, and you were saying how high that you were, and I started saying, "Hey man, you need to stop screaming." And you're like, "I'm not screaming." He's like, "Dude, seriously, we're going to get in trouble. You're like fucking screaming your fucking head off." And Chad started to
Chad started doing like weird like chants and drones behind me, like getting behind one of my ears and going like.
Oh, I forgot about that. I think I was so committed to my like, I'm going to gaslight you so hard that.
But I knew you were kidding. I will say, and I'm not trying to throw him under the bus, I remember being more disturbed by Chad than like I knew you were fucking with me face to face. Chad was doing more like subterfuge, like
right.
Making sounds that I'd be like, "You guys hear that, right?" And him being like, "No." And then me being like, "You definitely are making that sound." And him being like, "I haven't made any sound." Like, I remember that fucking with me a lot. But I remember talking about. You don't have to apologize for that. That was funny.
Cool.
I mean, that got very intense.
Well, I just,
it
you
did
know,
hit a point where I like froze up and was like, "I can't."
Yeah. And I didn't can't. Like, when you froze, I think you just left. It was like one of those things like, "Ah, that was so funny." And then now, and maybe it's because I have a child, but I was like, I will cut to my daughter being fucked with by people, you know, and I'm like, "Don't you fucking," and so I've had this like my I've always been really compassionate and stuff, but in comedy, especially like at that theater, the line between doing bits and existing in bits got very blurry sometimes.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so I just want, like, if it...
No, that was hilarious.
Okay, good.
Because I also remember, it being way too much.
Yeah.
And I remember it hitting a point where of me being like, "I can't, like, function." But I also remember simultaneous to that, you were laughing so hard that you were, like, crying. It's because I knew. It's like I knew you were kidding, and then you would also, being a master of commitment, just be able to snap into it and be like, "No, seriously, stop yelling!" And be like, "Huzzy, you have to stop." "No, I'm not yelling." You'd be like, "Whoa, slow down." Yeah. But I also remember the joy you took in it, and I was aware that it was really funny, even though it was freaking me out. Also, let's be clear as well. That era of my life, my mental state, it's not like anybody around me was responsible for my like things would hit tipping points with me very quickly, and I think people around me were aware of that because I was hiding it. So I think it also hit a point where I was like, "I gotta get the fuck out of here." This
I think that
that's
was,
not on you guys.
I think that's probably like citing my daughter and protecting her and stuff.
Yes,
it's like I guess my point is, like, I finding out afterwards, like, oh shit, he was dealing with some stuff.
Yeah,
I didn't want to be the person who's like, yeah, now he's in an institution because you were doing this kind of lame bit after a
can you
a college
imagine
show.
Fucking, that would have been so fucking on brand for back then though with those Torco shows.
Yeah,
be like, all right, so you're gonna fly a fucking airline that will shut down 6 days after you fly. You're gonna fly the last flight this airline ever flies because we're gonna spend $4 a piece.
Yeah,
on
$40 round trip tickets.
And then we're going to rent you guys a cargo van with no windows because it's the cheapest option, and you're going to drive 7 more hours.
But we're going to spend the majority of our budget on BB guns, fireworks.
I remember one time someone who shall not be named, who I'm friends with, who I've loved. Yeah. I remember once doing shows where they're like, hey, like, we know you already took the workshop, but the budget actually got fucked up, and we don't have the money to pay you for the workshop because I was supposed to get a little extra. And I was like, you literally bought fireworks and BB guns, and everyone's been drinking for free, and I don't even fucking drink alcohol.
I know.
Give me my fucking money. What the fuck, man?
I know.
So, like, the mental state of all of us on those tours was not good.
That was the thing. Steph and I had to talk to this person. It's like, look, we are approaching 40. We don't want to be in this world. Like, we're just doing it because we love improv and a little bit of money, but don't make me feel like I'm that weirdo hanging out with some college kids getting fucked up.
Yeah.
Like, not into that. Yeah. You're like, right. Cool.
The joy in this for me can't be like, oh, check it out. Now we get
check
to go to
it
a
out.
House
I'm sad
party.
As shit.
Yeah. Then we get to go to a house party. It's no, like, dude, pay me for the work I did.
Let me go home and watch some cable, please.
And, like, if you want to go to the parties, I'm not mad at you about it, but don't not pay me. And then I turn around and every asshole who's ever wanted a fucking, every asshole who's ever wanted a free drink is getting bought them on the company card. I'm like, then pay
completely.
Me.
I know. It's fucking wild. Oh, good times,
so they
man.
They were all built to push us to our limits. So you might, I would have felt if I had wound up losing myself mentally and you blamed yourself,
mm-hmm.
That would have just been the tipping point, but that there was a vast sea of unpredictable behavior.
Yeah.
So don't worry about it, man.
Oh, that's cool. Well, feels good to get it out there. Yeah, I was just always like, yeah, that kind of did my crawl a little bit, so I'm glad we got to. And it's documented, right? Legally, you can't sue me, if anything, because it's on the podcast.
Well, I mean, that was at least 15 years ago, so.
Well, I don't know what the statute of limitations for gaslighting comedy bits are, but
it was because I have to imagine, like, if I'm, you know, we're all prone to exaggeration as comedians, but I think you, the just to be clear to anyone listening, the whole thing of you telling me to stop yelling, and I was also really high and I rarely get high, so I'm trying to rein it in. Am I exaggerating if I say that this went on for minimum 35 minutes?
Oh yeah, it was. No, it was
35 minutes of you telling me to stop yelling when I never yelled.
That was the thing. It was continual. Like, we couldn't.
And that's a minimum.
Yeah. There was we didn't get into having any kind of conversation or anything because, other people start talking. And if you opened your mouth, it was like, dear God, dude, fucking, I am worried about you because you are screaming. Every
I remember
time.
Just sitting on the edge of a bed, staring directly at the floor for a long time, just feeling like I don't know what to do.
It is like the worst improv. It's basically like, you cannot talk in this scene. But please do, because it'll be really funny when you talk again.
But I mean, for a whole generation, my first 3 or 4 years at UCB, I was kind of collectively everybody's little brother.
Yeah.
And it was just reflective of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that, like, even on, like, Sunshine Gang, like, your character being Peanut, you know, which you
was,
played so, I mean, you just.
It was fun.
It was so good at that.
That was a great show that was kind of forgotten in the.
I know.
In the oral tradition of our scene, but that was the fucking best show.
I know. I hope there's some photograph somewhere. Who knows?
Fantastic.
Well, let's end there, and let me ask, what would you like to be promoting? Because I know you have a new book, right?
Yeah, I put out a new thing called Dad on Pills, which I actually feel like people who like conversations like these might like. I just wrote a thing about what it's been like to become a dad while also being somebody who's been like medicated for, you know, 20 years of my life and all the self-questioning that comes with that. And it's like a pretty funny book that has some real shit in it too.
Cool.
And yeah, if you go to try.scribd.com/gethard60, you can read it for free. That very easy to remember link. Or just go to my social media.
But you can buy it too, right? Don't you?
No, it just exists. This service Scribd came through and they were like, they wanted to pay me money to write it. They asked me if I had any ideas. I was like, here's the thing I most want to write. They were like, that's exactly what we're looking for.
Oh, that's rad.
It's an ebook and an audiobook, this one, and doesn't exist physically, which is kind of a bummer, but it's also the modern world, right?
Yeah. That's great, though. I can't wait to read it. I love your stuff.
Yeah, man. I think you might like it.
Cool. Well, Chris Gethard, I love you, man. I'm so happy we got to
chat. Dude, you're the best. I love you, too. It really is. Anytime we get to catch up, it just, like, really reminds me of a fire that I've always had that sometimes feels like it's gone out, but it's good to remember that it's like, oh no, right, like a whole bunch of us got in the fucking trenches together and did a lot of cool shit.
Yeah, we're still doing it, so it's good. And let me know, and just let us know what happens with your hair, you know, if it's
let me ask you honestly, like, is it, I feel like I am regarded as someone who is balding, but I, for the life of me, I can't tell the rate at which it's getting worse.
I mean,
I feel like it's always looked largely like this. This forever, this fucking purgatory head.
I feel like it is too. But I mean, think you kind of have, you've got what Sting's hairline, basically.
Yeah.
And so you should start playing lute and have 6-hour sex sessions.
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like there's some other there's some other good. You know, if you were in Britain, nobody would blink. I feel like you have a very British hairline.
Wow. That might be a new low.
No, they're great. And then you can shave your head there and you'll just fit in.
Start doing push-ups,
yeah. And then you'll get really jacked and then you have a fake Cockney accent. And everybody's like, oh my God, Gethard lost it. He finally lost it. Who knows? All right, man. Everybody check out Chris Gethard's new book and go bald if you're into it. It's a rush. All bald talk. Talking bald, yeah. Life is unfair when you lose all your hair. But now you've got someone to talk to. Brian and Charlie have a hairless party.
Hey, it's Mia.
Hey, it's Allie.
And we host the Rom-Com Review podcast, P.S. I Love Rom-Coms.
Each week, we'll have incredible guests come and discuss a new rom-com, grand gestures, meet-cutes, and of course, that elusive chemistry. Mia, what are you doing holding that giant boombox over your head? I'm hoping to win over listeners with this grand gesture. Take us back! Find a new episode every week and subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Brought to you by Campfire Media. Wow, you're still holding that boombox.
Yeah, I've got great upper body strength. Thanks, CrossFit.
P.S. I love rom-coms.
I love rom-coms.
Campfire.